Okay. Thanks, Eugenia, for joining me today.
No worries.
So maybe to kick off with, we'll do a little bit of an intro to who you are and what you do.
Yeah.
And also feel free to kind of expand on that term creative of color, you know, and how you relate to that. Because in the interviews I've done so far, people have a different relationship with what that means.
Sure.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that in terms of all of my work, I'm always very upfront about my identities as an Aboriginal Chinese Malaysian Muslim woman. That informs my work, and so that becomes really important for me. And I always make sure that that's really front and center in my bio, like that's important for me. I mean, I think that I sometimes wonder about the term people of colour. Like, I get it as an umbrella term. I think that it speaks a lot more to race politics overseas than it does here. And I think that, you know, for me, particularly as an Indigenous woman, that identifying as First Nations is important because that is about sovereignty. That is about connection to country. And that also is about a really unique perspective, a really unique identity, a unique struggle that if you lump all people of colour together really erases that. And that's, you know, if we're talking about Australia, that is the central issue in Australia, is about that takeover or that denial of First Nations people's sovereignty to have the state of Australia over the top. So in terms of my work, like, that's really important for me. In terms of what I do, I work across a number of different, I suppose, art forms. I mean, first and foremost, I am someone who works with communities around community organizing. I also work around you know, community development, community cultural development. I've worked with young people in theater, in dance. I've worked around skills development across a whole range of different art forms. I've done like quite a few different things in terms of community cultural development. And then also I'm a writer as well. That sort of writing for me is really important for my own creativity.
I did notice that when I was doing, you know, a little bit of research, as you do, ahead of this interview, and going, wow, Eugenia wears a lot of hats.
I do, like, lots of different things. And I suppose I like that. I like being able to work across diverse art forms and do just different interesting bits of work.
Well, so how this conversation came about is because, to be quite honest, I'm struggling at the moment, and you know some of the details of, like, some of the context that I'm, like, struggling to be inside of and kind of to make work in in my case as a storyteller, and then in the spaces we've been in, you know, trying to grow a creative business as well. So one of the main aims of this interview series is to kind of get a sense of survival strategies. So if you don't mind, I might launch into the first, you know, question, which is, how are you surviving white supremacy?
I have, well, first of all, I come from a long lineage of survivors on both my Chinese Malaysian and my Aboriginal side. And when we talk about survival in a country like Australia, that means survival of First Nations people for over 200 and however many years of white supremacy. And when we say white supremacy, people just switch off, right? Or they go, I don't know what that means. That means genocide. That means massacres. It means rape and gendered violence. That means the stolen generation, literally taking people's children away. That means forbidding Aboriginal people to speak their language, to practice their culture and their religion. That means denying Aboriginal people the ability to even hunt or eat their own traditional foods. That means a denigration of Aboriginal people based on their race, making fun of their culture, putting their culture down, shuts, you know, placing a primacy and a supremacy on British and Western culture, yeah. all of those sorts of yeah. things. So when we talk about survival, I come from a really, really, really long lineage of surviving white supremacy.
Yeah.
Very similarly on my Chinese side.
Yeah.
Like my mum was a fighter, like 1,000%.
Mm.
So survival on the one hand comes very naturally to me, but on the other hand it's really, really difficult.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
like you get worn down and tired. It can take a toll on your, not only your physical health, but your mental, emotional, and spiritual health.
Yeah,
it can be really, really difficult.
Mm.
I suppose I've done a number of different things in terms of like strategies for survival, if you want me to talk about
that. Yeah, I'd love for you to talk about that. Yeah,
I mean, I think number one of the lessons I learned really, really early on was pick your battles.
Mm.
So it's important to go to be able to walk away from some things and to go, I'm not going to pick up that fight because all it's going to do is make me upset or affect my health or drain my time or my resources. That's all that's going to do for me for very little gain. So I think picking your battles, like, first and foremost.
Mm-hmm.
And secondly, having really good support networks.
Yeah.
And I've been really lucky in that regard. Particularly older women who have just taken me under their wing.
Wow.
Who have given me support, who have extended a hand of friendship, whose work I admire and have been able to build upon because they paved the way. Like that sense of community and network has been very strong and powerful for me. And my family as well. I'm very privileged to have a good relationship with family and to have some really close-knit friends that provide that level of support.
Can I unpack a couple of those things that you said, strategies? And thanks for sharing as well, because that's, you know, really, I don't know, it's just important to hear it, you know, to hear it out loud. In terms of pick your battles, right? Can you describe your decision-making process in terms of, you know, you're faced with a certain situation and share however much or however little you want, right, of your experiences. How do you decide whether this is a battle that, you know, yes, it might affect me, you know, but I'm going to put in at least this much time or energy, or I'm going to stick it around until this happens or this milestone. What's your decision-making process there with which battles to pick?
Sure. If it's starting to make you feel no good, there's no point. Yeah. Yourself is more important than that battle. So if it's starting to make you feel no good, don't bother going forward.
Right.
I think also, I mean, partly it is also whether you think you're going to win or not. Like, take, for example, Facebook, right? People have Facebook arguments all the time.
Yeah.
In a Facebook argument, it's like, I'm never going to change this person's point of view. What is the point?
Sure.
Whereas if you do think, I think maybe this will, like, this person's coming around, then you might want to keep going. You know what I mean? So I think there's a little bit of, like, do I think that this is actually going to create any change, or is this literally just going to make me upset with no outcome whatsoever? So that's kind of like a bit of the decision-making process that goes into it. I mean, I think also, you don't always get it right. Sometimes you just go into something and then halfway through you're like, this was a really bad idea. But I think if it's making you, if it's giving you a no good feeling, and, like, you know, your body is telling you that you're unhappy or, you know, that kind of stuff.
Listen to that. If I might share, I was in a situation last year where my direct line manager, who's the most powerful person in that organization, who is a white woman, had an acute attack of white fragility. Ironically, during a workshop on white fragility, run by Robin DiAngelo herself, who coined white fragility.
Yeah.
And then I tried, I picked that battle, you know, and I tried to have a conversation with her, and it really didn't get anywhere.
Yeah.
So then I took that conversation higher up, to the next level, and then to the level after that. But I could see that in terms of the culture of the organization, it wasn't really going to make a difference.
Yeah.
You know, people knew there was an issue,
yeah,
but it didn't mean that they were going to change anything about, yeah, the culture of the organization. So in that situation, that organization works a lot with young, culturally diverse young people. I could see, I'm trying to get at eventually maybe getting your insight or input on this. I could see that the organization will continue to work with communities of color, young people.
Yeah.
And so, even though I felt like I lost the battle organizationally, like inside the organization, but I felt like there was a certain duty to kind of at least put the word out there that, hey, if you're going to work with this organization, just be on guard.
Yeah.
You know? What do you think of that? Where, you know, I guess in my way, that was my way of contributing, where, okay, I tried it internally in the organization, going up the ranks and all that. Didn't really get anywhere. So at the very least, I might put the word out there to try and protect some community members in their future dealings with this organization. Do you ever do that where it's like, it's kind of like a going around the problem strategy rather than addressing the problem directly?
Yeah, I mean, I think that going around stuff, I mean, that's what boycotts do, that's what, you know, like, that's a strategy that I think people have employed for a long time, and I think it's one that's important. I mean, I'm a big believer in, like, I've participated in call-out culture, and I've done that sort of stuff before, and I think that calling in is a far better way to do that. I think in your circumstance, you know, where sometimes the ability to create change in organizations like that, it's difficult when you're not at a higher up level.
Right, because it's so hierarchical.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Sometimes I like to bide my time to just go, okay, well, that's noted. And if it comes up in conversation, someone asks me, you know, confidentially, what do you think about X, Y, and Z?
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, to have that conversation with someone.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes I go, well, we'll just wait and see, and that might come out in the wash. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
that at some point I might be your boss, or at some point I might be on the board of that organization, or I might be in a position to actually to make that change when I couldn't escalate that as a worker through to the top, that at some other point in the future that might flip.
So have you seen that happen?
Yeah. Okay,
that gives me hope, because, like, you know, when people say that, I'm like, yeah, but what if your career stops at a certain point because of these blockages, you know?
Yeah.
So,
And I think there's, like, a mix between being not letting go of your integrity and your values, but also I'm not really a game player, but I think that there are ways that you can work with people to achieve what you want, that some people would go, oh, you're selling out or whatever, and it's like
playing the game,
but there's a long game, you know what I mean? Like, there's a strategy there that if I let this little thing go, then in the long run I can eventually create bigger change. You know what I mean?
Can I ask about that, because I'm not very good at that. A couple of things you brought up, I'm like, yeah, I'm not very good at that. You know, like the biding your time thing.
Yeah.
What do you do? How do you do that in a way that's healthy? You know, biding your time when maybe you've been confronted with a situation or a person or interaction.
You've got to let stuff go so the anger doesn't eat you up. And I'm not very good at that either.
Okay, right, because I'm really bad at that.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
But I feel
share
like
tips. Yes. But I feel like when you get older, that gets easier to do. From
practice?
Yeah, yeah, okay. From practice. Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
And also, I've got, like, friends and family that sometimes I can ring them an event and they just go, you should listen to yourself. You know, like, this is not the hill to die on. Like, this is not the thing that you should kill yourself over. Like, this is the thing that you should let go. Because in the future, something better will come along, or, you know, some good change will happen, and, like, just let that go. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
so I've got some pretty good, like, what I would call handbrakes, people who are just, like,
who
just help me stop the brakes and be like, you're getting worked up over something that in the long term is really insignificant.
Mm. So they really help you to kind of maintain that big picture perspective.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that that's also, then that has helped me develop that technique for myself to go, I am so in the micro detail of how this is upsetting me.
Right.
But if I pull out from it, actually that's really insignificant, or I'm going to go on and move on to something better.
Right.
Or, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, yeah, to help with that big picture stuff.
And it sounds like there's a level of trust that's needed there, you know? You have to trust that something better will come along. You have to trust that this is the right thing to let go of in order for the bigger thing to unfold.
Yeah.
Do you?
And I think that just comes from religion for me. I mean, other people might have other ways of having that, but I have faith and trust that... that everything will come out in the wash.
Mm.
Some people might call that karma. Some people might say, you know, like,
It's interesting because it's kind of been a connecting thread in the last two interviews I've done as well with Priya Srinivasan and with Amanda Ma. Both when I asked about, you know, how do you process, you know, whatever comes up for you in the face of, you know, sometimes quite unjust situations, they bring up spiritual practice.
Yeah.
So if you're comfortable with it, can you just elaborate on that a little bit, Eugenia? Like, how do you practice that? Maybe on a daily basis. Like, is that something you touch base with on a daily basis?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, I pray and I don't know, it's just a different mindset when you think about, like, having that faith and trust in something that's external to you.
Yeah.
That actually this will be taken care of and it's okay.
Yeah. There's conversations I've had with people in Indonesia have been a little bit aligned with that as well. What is that? It's interesting. There's a word called kodrat.
Yep.
Yeah.
Kodrat.
Right.
In Arabic, right?
Yes, I think it's the Arabic root, but
it's
been taken into... Yeah, where my understanding of that word is that, you know, everyone has their own kodrat or the thing that they are assigned to in life.
Yeah.
In terms of the opportunities, the life path.
Yeah.
Sometimes, though, I do get the sense that kodrat, in my understanding and experience of it in Indonesia, it sometimes gets used to justify injustice. Ini memang kodrat saya, you know.
Yeah.
Oh, this is just my destiny, or this is my what is that? Jatah, you know, like... this is what has been allocated to me in my life. And then people don't fight.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah, and I mean, I think that that's probably the wrong way to go about that. I mean, I think it's a fine line between saying that these things are like, this is what it is.
Right.
And going, that you also have, like, even though that is the case, you should still do what is right. You know, if there is injustice, you should still try to fix that. Like, I don't think that, like, I know with Islam in particular, it doesn't, it never advocates for just letting things happen. You know, there's that thing about you should tie your camel, right? Like you should.
Yeah, yeah.
That you need to be taking all of the precautions.
Yeah.
Or you need to be... there is a certain level of personal responsibility.
Yeah. Yeah. You don't just leave it for Allah. You still put in the effort to keep your camel secure, tie your camel up.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah.
But I think that, yeah, you just have to be making some decisions about, okay, is this the thing that I want to be fighting for, or is that something I can let go because there are bigger fights ahead, or that kind of thing.
Mm, 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 mm. Cool. All right.
Thank you.
No worries. I might segue to the next question, which is it's a very pragmatic one. How do you pay your bills?
I left full-time employment, and now I do about a million different jobs.
Wow.
Okay. So not as many as some other people that I know, but yeah, I mean, I do part-time contract work. I do
for like arts organizations or otherwise?
Yes, arts organizations.
Okay.
And university as well, because I'm moving into academia.
Ah, interesting. Okay.
So
in what way are you going into that?
I'm doing, well, I've paused at the moment, but I'm partway through a PhD.
Mm-hmm.
I would like to work for a university full time at some point in the future.
Mm-hmm. Okay, okay.
But yeah, I mean, I think that's, yeah. And then I do sort of freelance writing stuff, community cultural development work, that kind of stuff, and a bit of community organizing as well.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And so that's how all of that cobbled together somehow is how you pay
the bills. Yeah.
Okay. Okay.
Yep. I'm privileged that I'm partnered with someone who also works.
Okay.
I mean, he earns less than I do, and for a long time was long-term unemployed. So we were a single income household for a long time. But
it helps that.
But it helps that I'm partnered with someone. You know, there's lots of people that don't partner with people and, you know, only having one income for a really long time can be really difficult.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. And can I ask, just going back to survival strategies, right?
Yeah.
When you're juggling so many different, you know, gigs, right?
Yeah.
Is there anything you want to pass on in terms of the listeners, you know, who might be considering that path, or maybe there's in full-time employment, part-time, underemployed, who knows? How you do that in a way that's sustainable from what you've learned so
far. Sure. Yeah. I've learned that it's not very sustainable.
Okay, yeah.
I've struggled. Yeah, I've struggled since I left full-time employment.
Right, okay.
Doing multiple different things.
It's just really hard. Yeah.
It's hard. It's hard because you are pulled in a million different directions. It's hard because if you work somewhere one day a week, quite often you just naturally end up spending more time.
Yeah.
Than you're paid for.
Yeah.
It's difficult.
Okay.
And your head is pulled in a million different places. Sometimes you're traveling from place to place.
Yeah.
To cobble together that money.
Yeah.
Or you're working long hours, or you're working 24/7, or you're a freelancer, and so you work at midnight on Saturday night.
Yeah.
And
okay.
It's really, really difficult.
So that's why maybe the long-term dream is to be in full-time employment in an academic setting.
Yeah, I mean, or even just like part-time employment where I could, that paid enough that I didn't have to take on high-intensity freelance stuff, that I could do more creative stuff.
Yeah. Thank you for being honest about that.
Yeah, no, that's okay.
Yeah. Well, this is actually a good segue into something we've touched on already. It's about how you practice self-care, however you might define that. And I'm really aware that, you know, you've touched on it already, right? In terms of like the handbrakes that you have in your life, who are the people who kind of get you to pause, you know? Because I think, you know, self-care can be interpreted as such an individual thing, when actually for a lot of people, it's actually community is what caring for oneself is. But I guess I'm interested in your take on that, you know?
On what I do for self-care?
Yeah.
I'm not very good at it.
Okay.
I'm not very good at taking care of my health. I have a lot of unseen chronic illness, or what people would call a disability, a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's not something that a lot of people know about me.
Mm-hmm.
And it sometimes it feels like it almost requires that I don't work full time because I have that many doctor's appointments.
Right.
So in an ideal world, self-care would be keeping up with all of those appointments and actually taking better care of my health.
Mm-hmm.
And exercising. Exercising really helps with anxiety and depression, and being really, really honest that I suffer from both of those things.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And
I live with anxiety as well. Yeah.
And in an ideal world, I would exercise more. Mm-hmm. That would help with that.
Mm-hmm.
And also in an ideal world, I would get out of the city more often.
Mm.
I don't like to use the word on country because the city is someone's country too.
Mm-hmm.
It's the Kulin Nation's country here in Melbourne. So I kind of don't like to say going out on country because this is their country.
Yeah.
But getting out of the city is important to me. Getting back to Darwin or Malaysia, even Adelaide, where I grew up, those things are important to me.
Mm-hmm.
I don't do them often enough.
Yeah.
Visiting family.
Yeah.
Saying no to things is probably one of the biggest things you can do. Like learning to say no for self-care is just hugely important.
Yeah.
To just be like, do you want to do this? Yeah, I do. But do I realistically have time to do that? No, I don't.
Or energy.
Or energy.
Am I healthy enough to do that?
Yeah. So learning to say no to things has been a huge act of self-care.
Mm.
And regular therapy.
Mm.
So I have a really good therapist at the moment, and we're working on all of those sorts of things.
Yeah.
So
that's wonderful.
That's a huge bit of self-care that I do.
Thank you. Yeah, and thanks for sharing that much as well, you know, about things that, you know, obviously not many people know about, you know, about
I think it's difficult because you get stigmatized.
Yeah.
So my husband also suffers from some pretty extreme chronic illness,
mm-hmm.
and last year was in and out of hospital a lot, and we were quite public and open about that.
Yeah.
And I've got to say, gigs fell away for him. He's a musician.
Wow.
People didn't book him because he was unreliable. And I was like, if he wasn't a freelancer, and if this was an employment organisation, that is fucking illegal.
Yeah.
To discriminate.
Yeah.
Based on someone's illness.
Yeah.
So we've made the decision not to be open about that anymore,
mm-hmm.
unfortunately, because we felt like it was impacting people's perception of us.
Mm.
And mm-hmm.
I have to ask, is this a part that you'd rather edit out of the audio than in that case? Or do you want to think about
no,
it?
No, that's okay. Yeah.
Okay. Right. Well, you just let me know. You know,
sure.
If you change your mind. Yeah.
Yeah.
Where to from here? I suppose maybe, hang on, I'm just going to check the time as well. Maybe if we are, I think we're good. Yeah, we're good. It's actually quite a good segue in terms of why do you keep going? You know, why do you keep going in your practice as a writer, as a community worker, you know, all of that. Especially since what you're describing is like this tapestry of challenges, you know, and even when you're trying to take care of yourself, it's challenging even just to try and take care of yourself, you know?
So and my friends talk about this all the time, and my sister, we talk about this a lot, about like, oh, why do we do this to ourselves?
Yeah,
you know,
totally.
These jobs that don't pay very much, that there's so much drama, you're always overworked, unstable employment.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
Why do we bother? I think because a government job, even though I would probably be earning well above the 100k mark by now, if I had stayed on a particular career trajectory.
Yeah.
you know, I would probably be really high up there. I would probably be dead inside. I think I would be bored. Yeah, and I just don't think I would be. I don't think I could be just a cog in a machine. That's not for me. I mean, for some people, like that sense of stability, and that kind of like I go to work 9 to 5 and I do this job. Like that's what they're into. Man, I wish I could be like that. And I think that I'm trying to. I think. I mean, I guess what I'm trying to do is get in the middle, like the middle ground. And also, at times, I've gone actually. I need to pull back on this, and I just need that 9 to 5 job to save up some money, to be stable, to not have to worry or think or be overworked. Sometimes you just need that, and I think that's okay too, like to be able to retreat into those jobs for a while to rebuild and that kind of stuff. But I mean, like keeping on going, I don't know, these are just things that I'm passionate about, and I think also I have a certain set of privileges as a person who is educated, who has cultural capital, who lives on the East Coast in a major city, the second largest city in the country. You know, there are other people that live rurally, remote, who even in Adelaide live in other places that aren't Melbourne or Sydney. It is a privilege to live here. It's a privilege to be educated and all those sorts of things. And so with that privilege comes responsibility and accountability to keep fighting and to do things, not to run yourself down completely, but to make a contribution.
But acknowledging that we have access to resources that maybe some people don't.
Yeah.
Just by virtue of living here.
Definitely.
It kind of brings me to another question in terms of like what gives you hope. And you know, I saw your post recently, I think on your blog, in terms of Black Thoughts Live Here, in response to the election results. And I think what I gained from that post was, you know, your ability to kind of really summarize how all the different parts of the system and culture and ways of thinking, of course, has led us to here, you know, so it's not surprising at all. So in that context, you know, like, how do you nurture hope?
Well, that's difficult one because I'm a pretty negative person.
Okay.
I'm a negative person, but also I balance that. I have had a really extraordinary set of circumstances in my life that I think if you were to reflect on it, I've had a pretty shitty life.
Right, okay.
But by the same token, I've also had a really privileged, loving, great life in lots of different ways. But I'm definitely one of those people that has battled and been challenged my entire life. But that's... so sometimes I can get really negative. Like, sometimes it's like life has just taught me that things are shit. And that's how I feel about stuff. Everything's shit. But, hope. I don't know. Sometimes you can... Maybe that comes back to faith a little bit. That, like, things can improve or change. But also... That's not about just giving that up to God and saying, you know, I have that hope and faith. That is about actually
actively.
I'm working towards that. And if I can just get over this little thing, then things will be that little bit better, and that little bit better, and that little bit better. Definitely a chipper, like just chip away at things.
And then maybe by chipping away, it also feels maybe a bit more manageable as well. Because, I mean,
definitely.
You're not trying to take on the whole big chunk of thing. It's a chipping away.
Yeah.
Can I ask you one more question?
Yeah, of course.
Because this has come up recently for me, and I'm just aware with your background as, you know, Chinese Malay as part of your cultural heritage as well. I'm not sure if you followed that last week there was politically motivated riots in Jakarta, in Indonesia.
No, I didn't see that.
Yeah, yeah. To be honest, I think a lot of people were waiting for that to happen.
Sure.
Because they announced the election results over there. Right.
Yes.
And then Prabowo, who is the one that is, you know, officially at least announced that he has lost, there are people who are supposedly maybe his supporters who then went and, you know, rioted on the streets and all of that. And that was a big reminder for me as someone who's, my family sent me here after the last time there was politically motivated violence towards Chinese Indonesian people.
Yeah.
In May 98.
Yeah.
So, you know,
remember that.
Right, right. So I've been struggling with kind of the institutional racism here in professional contexts here, right? Which my experience of that is it sometimes feels really suffocating, you know? You're just trying to make work, but instead you're coming up against these walls, right? And then I hear this news, literally on the anniversary of the last of the violence that happened, which caused me to, you know, caused my parents to send me to Noongar country in Perth. Then there's this other explosion of riots, right? Kind of at the same time as I was struggling with institutional racism here. And so it gave me this real sense of like, oh my God, like nowhere is safe, you know? And like, even if I entertain fantasies of going home, home is not safe, right?
Yeah.
But then here is not safe either. People might not necessarily be, in my case anyway, I know some people are in this case where people literally want to hunt you down and kill you. I know there are people whose lived experience is like that here.
Yeah.
But in my case, that's not the case here, right?
Sure.
But it doesn't mean that the spaces I'm in are safe either.
Yeah.
And I guess I just wanted to sound that out and get your sense of like, you know, that way of moving through the world where nowhere feels safe.
Yeah.
Like, how the hell do you... How do you navigate that? Because at the moment, I just feel like I'm doing this awkward dance, and I'm full of tension, and you know, and then I'm reaching out through this project and going, oh my God, tell me some strategies, you know?
Yeah.
That's what I'm doing. Like, what do you do? Did that make sense?
Yeah, no, it makes perfect sense. Right, I'm not sure that I do anything.
Yeah.
I think that lack of feeling of safety is something that I've felt my entire life. That actually, yeah, nowhere is safe. That's not... that there's sort of nowhere that kind of is without racialized violence or, yeah, that kind of stuff. What do I do?
I mean, that kind of puts that question on your shoulders, which maybe that's not the right question. I just wanted to share it, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I think the other time I felt, well, one of the more recent times, maybe it's not a recent time, one time I really felt that way was after the Paris attacks.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I was like, you know, walking around in my hijab, and I was like, people are staring at me.
Yeah.
Yeah, people are staring at me, and people are... I'm a pretty ballsy person. Like, I'm a pretty... I'm not timid, or I don't scare particularly easy in terms of, like, walking around the streets and that sort of stuff. I'm visibly Asian. So I think, you know... my type of Asian has become very acceptable in Australia.
Yeah. Yeah.
But when I started wearing hijab,
right,
that changed for me. Mm. Like, I could walk around. I mean, I think during the Hanson era, I did get yelled at on the street.
Right.
But mostly just left alone. Right. Mm-hmm. But as soon as I put on the hijab, I was like, there is a very serious feeling of unsafety. And, you know, for lots of Aboriginal people, that has been that way for a long time. For lots of Asian people in Australia, that has been that way for a really long time. So I mean, I think that you're just building coping mechanisms, unfortunately. Yeah. You just, unfortunately, as time goes by, you start to develop or block it out. I don't notice it. When I first started wearing hijab, for example, I would walk with like my sisters or my friend and they'd be like, everyone is staring at you. And I would be like, oh wow, everyone is staring at me. But I don't even notice it anymore. And then sometimes I go somewhere and they're like, do you realize everyone is staring at you? And I'm like, I didn't even notice. No. It's so normal now. Yeah. So some, I don't know. I don't really have an answer except to say I totally know what you mean. And sometimes, you just, I don't know, learn to cope with it or block it out.
Yeah.
But there's also, like, you know, this is one of those things about racism can make people sick, you know. It can make you fearful and anxious, and it can, you know,
all the time.
And people don't understand what that's like, to have that onslaught of people actually hate me, that they would want to kill me, or people dislike me because of my race or religion.
Yeah.
Imagine being able to not have that. I don't know what that feels like.
Yeah.
I don't know what that's like.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, maybe to close it off, is there anything that you feel like, you know, in terms of going back to the survival strategy thing, because that's kind of the theme of the interviews, is there anything that maybe we haven't touched on that you feel strongly that, you know, you need to voice and share?
No, I think I covered everything.
Yeah.
I mean, I will say I've been very frank and honest in this. And, you know, that stigmatization is mostly what stops me from talking about my mental health issues or my physical health issues or, you know, a whole range of different stuff. But, you know, whatever. If people want to not offer me jobs or think about me differently, or then that's their problem.
You're making me think about a recent conversation I had with my mother and my auntie, who I look to them when I'm struggling. So I just had a conversation with them a couple of days ago, and they, you know, I described the difficult situation that I was in, needing to make a decision about, do I keep going with a particular working relationship, which has been super disrespectful of me and my team. And they said to me, you know, Rani, like, at the end of the day, what is it that will maintain your dignity and your team's dignity?
Yeah.
And I feel like this whole conversation, you know, and your honesty and your frankness and all of that, I just really admire it, because I think that is a way of maintaining dignity and just practicing dignity. So thank you. Thank you for being honest.
Thanks. It's been a wonderful interview, so thank you.
Thanks, Eugenia.
Yeah, no worries.
Yay.